And that was Pink Floyd. I'm sorry, I forgot the title.
Shine On You Crazy Diamond.
Shine On You Crazy Diamond.
What was
Diamond.
The album again?
Wish You Were Here.
Wish You Were Here. Okay. And that was from Ear Buddies doing their crazy show. Not their crazy show, but their show about being
the good
crazy.
Stuff.
Crazy music, right? Was that close, theme-wise?
Yeah.
I actually caught the theme on the way in. I was listening to the show. Hey, you're listening to, speaking of that, you're listening to 91.5 FM. You can get that over the air, out in the airwaves, out in the real world, not just virtual reality. Yeah. But if you're into that virtual reality thing, which I'm really down on lately, although I use it every day, check out WMFO.org. And right now we're going to switch over to Socialist Radio. We've changed our name, and I must use the old name, Socialist Radio. I'm Jeff Booth and
Diego.
And we're here every other week, talk and music from a working class, democratic socialist perspective. I'm pumped.
Truly.
I got a lot to talk about.
A truly democratic. Not this fake.
Yeah, not yet. Well, yeah, that's a good point. When I say democratic socialist, I'm not talking about the Democratic Party. I'm not talking about Bernie Sanders, who's in the Democratic Party. I'm not talking about, you know, the way that word, that term democratic socialist is getting bandied about lately. We got to define our terms a little better, but not just through talk, through action as well. And we do that. Let's see. I have to now do something else here, and we're, no, that didn't work. Oh, yes, it did. Great. Okay. So, again, welcome to Socialist Radio, talking music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. By the way, we are also legally known here as this radio station as WMFO Medford or WMFO in Medford, and as I said earlier, 91.5 FM on your radio dial if you're in the vicinity. We're sort of at the border of Somerville and Tufts on the bucolic campus of Tufts University, and we sometimes call ourselves Tufts Educational Radio, and we call ourselves Freeform Radio, and we're commercial free, and we have some community members, not just students, nothing wrong with students, but not just students, doing shows. I'm not a student, haven't been for a long time. You a student now, Diego?
No. Well, student of life.
Student of life,
I
yeah.
guess.
Student of the class struggle.
We're always students of something.
Yeah. So, and I'm not trashing education. I actually had a very interesting time in college. It was sacrifice to get in and pay for it and all that. But it was, I basically like not having to work. You know, I didn't like a lot of students even then and now especially have to work and go to school at the same time. I managed to, you know, shove all the work in during summers and vacations, and it was a union job. Union factory job, so I made enough money to pay for most of my school.
Those days are over.
Exactly.
Now you got to work three, and still struggle.
Yep, exactly.
Keep up with the...
But the point was that when I was actually in school, you know, September through December, part of December, I was relatively free. I mean, it was really a shock to me not to have to work, because I was already working off and on since I was 16. I really didn't get a real job until I was 17, but I had other, like, piecework when I was 16. You know, the neighborhood lawn, picking apples, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, we had apple orchards near where I grew up. So anyway, that was nasty. But the real grind started when I was 17, started working in a factory, a bunch of them in upstate New York. But it was unionized. It was in the Bakery Workers Union, big General Foods plants. At that time, known the brand name publicly was Fryoffer. Fryoffers, they're still around as a brand.
I know that.
They're not
man.
A real thing anymore, but yeah.
It's kind of German.
Yeah, yeah.
German name.
Yeah, and the founders
Dutch.
Were German. No, it's German, yeah.
Fryoffer.
Yeah, yeah. And the by the time I was working there, like the grandson of the original owner and his brothers were running
did you
it.
You put out the Sunbeam also?
Exactly.
Just put the slap the label on
you
it.
You know what happened.
I know, because I used to work at a longer bakery. Nah. Like, hey, we got to know. Those breads got to have the Fantini brand. Well, Fantini's in Haverhill. Why are we making their bread and putting the...
This is a
don't
secret.
Don't worry about it. That's our account. You know?
This is a secret that our brothers and sisters in the working class might not be totally aware of.
The difference of 50 cents
the
more
idea
or less,
of choice
you know?
In capitalism is not really what you're taught it is. Maybe you already figured that out. But I had a good friend that worked as a truck driver who ended up working in a peanut butter factory or had worked in a peanut butter factory. Same deal.
Yep.
You switch out the labels and the price goes up or down a little bit. depending on relatively
speaking.
Put
organic on it. Yeah, no, yeah. This is $3
and it can, and it's
versus
the same
$1.
Product. Now, that doesn't mean they don't ever have different product, right? So some bread, like when they did Italian bread, right, we'd have to throw some sesame seeds, or the machine would throw some sesame seeds on it. Yep. Yeah. And that was a little bit different. And there, and right next to us was an assembly line that did English muffins. And, you know, so there are different products, but there's also within those products, like, say, the English muffins or the basic wheat bread or something, all kinds of different brands being put on the same product to fool you, to make you think you're getting some special brand or something. And that still happens. Of course, now they would throw the word artisanal or something on it.
Yeah, okay.
I don't even know how to say that word. Artisanal?
You know what artisanal bread is? When my mother makes it herself. That's artisan.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And my mother still makes bread. I know. Shocking.
I knew somebody that made bread, but they were a professor, so they had some time on their hands. But anyway, yeah, so college was like... Now, again, I know a lot of people have to work jobs during college, and so that's really hard. I never had to do that, luckily, so college was, felt like freedom. And of course, depending on the year and the professors I had and the people I was around, students I was around, sometimes it was damn interesting. It was really, really interesting stuff for a working class kid, you know. And all the reading I had done, which was considered weird growing where I grew up, paid off enormously. I'm trying to teach that to my son. He's not quite listening.
What? Reading?
Just as much reading as you can do. I mean, obviously, if you just read total garbage, it probably won't help you, but you're bound to read something interesting. Like, say you pick up Game of Thrones or something, right? That's just fantasy, right? But there's stuff going on that's interesting psychologically.
It's all about the
sociopolitically,
series.
Yeah. There's references to other things. Anyway, it all connects. Read as much as you can. Read voraciously.
Or maybe read about cultures like the Mayans, the Vikings, you know.
Yeah. Or maybe, that might get you interested in that, right? Yeah. Yeah. Or maybe you're just really good at school, which I wasn't.
Medieval Europe.
And you don't need to read you don't need to read all the time, but it doesn't hurt at all. I mean, it can add to your being really good at school.
Read some novels that, you know, like Richard Wright.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
James Baldwin.
Yep. Absolutely.
The list goes on and on.
It
Black
goes
Jacket
on and on. There's writers, really good writers writing right now.
John Reed that wrote the 10 Days That Shook the World.
That'll blow your mind.
It's based on a real situation, but he wrote it like a novel.
He was an eyewitness. Mm-hmm. 10 Days That Shook the World is a little known eyewitness account of the Russian Revolution by an American.
Tales of Two Cities. That's kind of like Charles Dickens' account of the French Revolution.
I didn't know that. I mean, I read it too.
But he wrote it like a novel, but he was actually there. Yeah. It's kind of like what John Reed did with the 10 Days That Shook the World.
Yeah. The thing is, also, I would urge people, and this is going to sound, who am I to preach, maybe to the choir here, in terms of some people I'm sure are listening are voracious readers, but it's good to reread stuff. Like, I don't really remember much about A Tale of Two Cities, because I read it when I was literally in high school. Good to reread stuff. Nothing wrong with that. People are like, why do you have books now? People question that, you know? I'm like, well, you know, I might want to reread some of it.
When the data computer crashes, what are you going to
read? Yeah,
yeah. Do?
When the
you just burn all your books.
What electronic pulse
451
hits.
Degrees. What was that novel?
Fahrenheit 451.
Fahrenheit 451.
Yeah. I went to a relative's place yesterday just to hang out and do a sort of late Christmas thing because we weren't able to get together over the holidays. And it was fun. And, we were talking about it came up in the way of like how since everything is streaming, you don't really own the record, the CD, the tape, the VHS tape, the DVD, all that's going out the window now, which is really, really bad because if what you don't own, you don't control in terms of under capitalism at least. And so I have lots of DVDs sitting on shelves. I have lots of books, tons of books. And one of the people there was like, yeah, I kind of agree, but on the other hand, we don't want to just collect more stuff. And it went back and forth as to the dangers of not being able to physically own the stuff or get it that way if you wanted to get it. So, for example, it might not be an option anymore in the near future to even have a download of something. You know, it might just be we stream it and we take it back like it is on Netflix. You know what I mean? So it's very problematic. There's a lot of ins and outs. I'm not a Luddite. I'm not against technology, but under capitalism, we don't choose the changes in technology. Like some of the people there were talking about stuff I don't quite understand fully, but how quickly the phones, like iPhone 8 versus iPhone 10 or something like that, how quickly they become obsolete, and how much more gets controlled every time there's a new type of device. And one person there was is really good at fixing things. And he said that he's got like a side gig fixing stuff, like electronics, you know. And he said that it's becomes harder and harder to fix. They make it on purpose harder and harder to fix. You can't even change a battery.
That's why you got waste. It's also on the capitalism.
Total waste.
Environmental waste, because that obsolete phone's going to go get dumped God knows where.
Yep.
And it's got toxins and stuff. All these, the batteries, the electronics.
Yeah. And a lot of the working people are probably aware of this right to repair debate and law and stuff. It was already voted on once, and the car companies basically just ignored it, kind of, to a certain extent. Where, like, cars are so complex now in terms of fixing them because you need computer codes and stuff, which, by the way, should make it simpler from a certain angle, but let's just go with the complex for a second, or the ownership angle. They own the codes. They say they own the codes, so screw everybody else that wants to get their car fixed or fix a car cheaper, like the smaller garages and stuff. And so there's a big fight over that. And there was actually something, I don't know if it was Massachusetts or nationwide, that made them cough up some of their codes, but they're making new ones. They're not coughing them up. They're not showing. So there's going to be another one on the Massachusetts ballot, I think, next year. Another right to repair law thing.
Here's an anecdote from my friend from Venezuela. Took his kids to Disney World on Christmas, that Christmas week, and went to rent a car. And he said, he got into the car. He's like, he doesn't understand much English. He's like, too complex for me.
Oh,
get another one.
Yeah.
His wife is like, don't push that button. You'll eject us or something. You know, this thing is like one of those. Yep. What, like, you ever seen Demolition Man?
Yep.
The movie?
Yep.
With Sylvester Stallone and Wesley Snipes.
Yep.
Where the car kind of runs by itself. And you give it an order. And if it crashes, you just have this foam that just engulfs you so you don't get killed in this car accident. That kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it's like, I just want a car that's simple. Just something that can, and go.
Well, I agree. That was one of the things that caused the discussion to happen, was something about cars. I can't remember what it was, being hard to fix and being very complicated. But also about how, this is a true story. Actually, I wish I'd printed it out. But I saw on Facebook or the internet, farmers in the U.S. Midwest, the United States, a lot of them are buying John Deere tractors from like 20 or 30 years ago to avoid the computerization so they can fix them easy. Think about what a waste that is. You have this new technology, but to implement under capitalism is a problem. And that's a lesson to learn, because under capitalism, new technologies can be harmful, very, very harmful. We don't decide on them. It's undemocratic. And they can be buried. Or misused, you know? Like, every time you come up with new technology, you think you're some cool computer geek working for slaving away for Google, which, by the way, they're firing people for trying to organize unions at Google now. You're slaving away at Google. Maybe you're making big bucks, though, so you're happy, and you get to play ping pong at lunch or something. I love ping pong. Don't take that the wrong way. So, anyway. So, like, but the minute you get that thing, I know, every house. The minute you get that thing done, right? The minute you get that thing done, Google owns it. And Google might give it to the military right away. Boom. So all of a sudden, you thought you made some cool app, and all of a sudden, the military is using it to assassinate people or whatever. You know what I mean?
And they've been doing that.
Of course. And that's a real story, without the details.
Sure.
Yeah. Which we'll get into the war, the almost war, in a few minutes, hopefully. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Socialist Radio. We're here every other Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Jeff Booth and Diego are hosting today. And we're sorry, I should let you say your own name. Go ahead.
James in English. Did you know that?
I had no idea.
If you look up,
that's hilarious. How did that work?
I had a name dictionary, and my name is James in English.
Wow.
I don't know.
That's amazing. My name comes from, I don't want to get into it. It's stupid. didn't we talk about this? My names are like so boring and stupid.
What,
my
Jeff
last name
Booth
means bossy hut. The cowherder's hut back in Scotland.
I thought Booth was a Swedish.
No. Scottish and English originally, and then Talaga, my mom's maiden name, is a Polish name. Believe it or not, it doesn't sound like it, but it's
Talaga.
Polish, and it means broken down wooden cart. So I don't have very much to be proud of. And my wife's name Rua, right? Means road.
Street.
Street. So,
rua.
So it's like,
rua
I want something more interesting and colorful for last names. I want to be like a last
not
name.
Not Barbosa, Somoza.
That would be nice.
My last name's Oyola, is Mayan.
I know someone named Mariposa. I don't know if that was her first name or last name.
Butterfly?
Yeah, butterfly. Beautiful.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Well, Oyola means warrior in Mayan.
That's not bad. Warrior? Warrior.
Warrior.
I thought you said warrior. Okay. No, warrior is excellent. Yeah. Warrior is a good name to have.
But in Mayan.
Yeah, no, that's cool. I know, I understand Mayan. It. I understand what Mayan is. Yeah, no, that's cool. That's really cool. That's really cool. Yeah, I wish I had that.
And Diego was like, oh, I don't know.
James, I don't know about that.
That's the Spanish part there.
Yeah. By the way, did you ever see that controversial Mel Gibson movie about the Spanish hitting South America, and he used the like native languages for the film with subtitles?
Get the Gringo?
No, no, it wasn't a comedy. It was... serious. I just can't remember the name. Apocalypto.
Apocalypto, yes.
Did you ever see that?
Yeah.
That was very controversial. Like, I know someone that studied anthropology and was really hating on that film. And I don't like Mel Gibson, of course. He's like anti-Semitic and God knows what else, but Catholic, ultra-Catholic and all that.
I'm going to say I've seen better films about...
Yeah. But I found it interesting.
About Maya. I
like hearing the language.
Too.
There's a show on Netflix now that's kind of...
And the hunting and the whole... living off the land.
Yeah, yeah. And the way the tribes interacted, although they were under stress
from the
invasion.
Well, then you had the Aztec thing, sacrificial.
I would guess, all right, I could be wrong. Nah, forget it. I'm not going to get into it. It's too complicated. But I was just going to say, like, I think he might have exaggerated the level of violence, but there were certain... The Aztecs were transitioning into slave society, so maybe not. But anyway.
Oh, so were the Mayans. There was other.
Yeah. They got to a certain point of development.
There were other tribes, other peoples I say we because I'm Mayan descent, by my grandmother's side.
I understand. Yeah.
And if you get closer to Panama and the border of Colombia, you get into Amazon. Now you get the Amazonian tribes that were oppressed by certain,
but tribal
society. But it wasn't like you said, like today, with the Europeans coming in.
No. That's a good point. You're bringing up a really good point. Like, tribal societies did have conflicts, but they tended to be, compared to now, or even compared to feudalism or slave societies, they tended to be very, very...
Limited,
yes. Because think about it. If your tribe is subsistence-level tribe... And you lose people in war, you're going to die when winter comes or when the monsoon comes or whatever it is down there. So now, though, those societies also were not static. I'm using Marxist, historical materialism now to talk about this. They weren't static. They were developing. And the climate down there was better than up here. So they developed, and have other factors as well, when human settlement first started there and all that kind of stuff. They just got to the point where they were growing enough food and so on that a leisure class started to develop. And like a lot of other places, the first way the leisure class kept its was slavery.
The trades, the spice trades.
But slavery, too.
Yep,
unfortunately,
slavery.
Yeah. Yep. And bloodier wars and stuff because people didn't like being enslaved, obviously. So it's a fascinating history. I mean, I've often used the argument in discussing, anthropology or actually comes up in discussions about human nature when I'm trying to recruit someone to the socialist movement, and I say, well, the vast majority of the life of humanity has been relatively peaceful tribal societies that were very kind of primitive communist societies. Primitive is not a judgment, it just means they were subsistence level, they didn't have high levels of technology.
Yep.
And then that's true, right? But up to a point, then there were some tribal societies that did, without outside so-called conquering or whatever, they did actually
develop,
quote-unquote,
like,
into slave societies.
The,
yeah. Yeah. And that became, that made their production even higher, of course at a horrible cost in terms of slavery, but it made their production levels even higher, blah, 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 and that was happening in different parts of the world, and then you had feudal societies come out of the slave societies and capitalism out of the feudal societies, and it wasn't all... Different parts of the world might be stuck in a previous
Look at China. They didn't build that wall for nothing. They were scared of other societies coming in.
Yeah.
The Mongols and what have you. They build a wall it's amazing.
Or fast forward to China, 1980s. They decide the Stalinists or the Maoists, same thing kind of. they had built up a certain infrastructure. China, before the Chinese Revolution, 1949, was very poor. Colonial powers were chewing it up. It was still, a lot of it was still feudal in a way. Maoism, and we don't support Maoism, but objectively speaking, it developed the economy much faster than capitalism was, to the point where everybody had education, food, you know, basics, healthcare, decent housing. That, you know, it wasn't perfect. We could get into that, why it needed to be more of a workers' democracy, or a workers' democracy, and not a guerrilla army in charge sort of.
Bureaucratic
dictatorship. But still, what they did in China was they took that infrastructure they built and they started to hand it over to the capitalists to come in and exploit. They took the leadership of the Communist Party, did their own exploiting. There's billionaires now on the Central Committee of the Chinese Communist Party.
Very few, but yeah.
Well, I heard it's a lot now. But anyway, either way, they it's state capitalist now is what I was leading up to. They turned all that stuff over to capitalism, but still with a strong state, some state-owned companies. But they try to run the state-owned companies like capitalist companies, you know. You work there, you don't know the difference between working there and working for Apple. It's just as brutal, you know. And anyway, so why don't we jump out of that? I mean, it was all related. It was all good. All good. But wait till you hear this. It's going to blow your mind, and hopefully the minds of our listeners. This is part of okay. So some of our listeners might be familiar with Counterpunch, counterpunch.org.
Chris Hedges.
No, that's Jeffrey St. Clair. Okay. Used to be Alexander Coburn, and Jeffrey St. Clair and others. It's just like a left wing. What to call it? It's a website that prints maybe like 10 essays a day. I could be off on the numbers. From various left-wing perspectives, they tend to have a common theme of, which I like, of not supporting the Democratic Party, although they do have people that do support the Democratic Party right in there, too. Sort of consistent left critique influenced by Marxism and other ideas. So this Jeffrey St. Clair has started a column called Roaming Charges. And he just writes like snippets, almost like an Instagram post or whatever, if I got that right. What's the one where you write 140 character words or less or something like that? Is that Insta?
I think so.
No, that's what Trump does. What does Trump do?
Oh, tweet.
Tweet, yeah.
Tweet.
Twitter. So he writes, it's almost like reading Twitter posts, but good ones. He's a good writer. And
Although Trump don't need a lot of words. He just goes, da, 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 da.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was thinking about Trump. I was thinking about, now, how could you have this dilemma of somebody, this contradiction? This is going to be another digression here. Pardon us. But so I think a lot of people think Trump is this cowboy figure, this lone wolf. Not at all. I think Trump is tightly controlled by that administration, and they like what he's doing. There's a section of the ruling class that likes what Trump is doing, even when supposedly he's screwing up. Meanwhile, you know, in the corporate media, there's just endless chatter about him screwing up something. Meanwhile, below the radar, he's attacking labor, he's attacking women, he's attacking all these rights that have been won in recent decades, and he's tearing them apart legally and trying to really hurt people in various ways and give everything to the companies. Environmental regulations tear them up, you know. But that's all. If you look at the
nuclear deals, tear it up.
Yeah, if you look at the through line, though. There's a consistency there. Capitalism. Pro-capitalist, pro-corporate, pro-big business. Screw the workers. And the cliche in the media is that a lot of workers like Trump. And some do. And I wish we could have a good discussion with them because they're wrong. I understand under the rules of the two-party duopoly that we're fed, you're supposed to, if you don't like one party in power, vote the other one, like a ping-pong thing, or believe in a one-party state like a lot of liberals do and just vote Democrat all the time, no matter what. I, of course, as socialists, as Marxists, we reject both both of those so-called options. We're for freedom, actually, real freedom, real democracy, where you have multiple political parties, where you have socialist parties, left parties in the picture. They're not in the United States. They're on the fringes.
Even coalitions, if need be.
Yep, coalitions.
Because it's
yep.
not going to be a perfect society. It's not going to be, okay, we're socialists. That's it, done.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to be a lot
especially
of ups and
especially
downs.
Building up to
build
a revolution, yeah.
Exactly.
Because right now you have liberals and Democratic Party people claiming that they somehow, like Sanders somehow represent, or AOC somehow represent socialism. They don't at all. And when they get in power, or when they get tossed out of the Democratic Party, one or the other, probably most likely they'll be in power like they are now. They won't be able to solve anything. They won't be able to do anything. And people with illusions in the Democratic Party, a certain percentage will, again, wake up. They have woken up in the past. But you have to be woken up, plus have a movement, plus have a workers' party, at least starting, to take advantage of all that. And the U.S. left has been notoriously weak and ineffectual in building what every other left in the world has built, its own political party, to compete on a mass basis with the capitalist political parties. That's the main problem here. People ignore it. They think you can either ignore electoral politics. You can. It's not the be-all and end-all. Protests in the streets like they're doing in France and India is absolutely necessary. But you can't ignore electoral politics either. Anyway, so maybe we'll end that digression, but go back to...
Counterpunch.
Counterpunch. Check it out. You get a chance. This is from Counterpunch. This is from Roaming Charges. But I found this... I feel like I'm fully woke, to use that thing again, about how greedy the super rich are, the billionaires are. I feel like I understand that. This kind of still blew my mind a little bit, because it doesn't cost...
It would be like greed?
Well, you'll see what I mean. Let's just... Yeah,
Is it beyond Darth Vader green? I mean, greed?
Yeah, it is. No, it is Darth Vader greed. So, first of all, this one is a little separate from what the main point, but Michael Bloomberg, by the way, who's running as a Democrat for the Democratic Party, and he's always been a good Democrat. And has he always been? Was he a Republican for a while?
Is that the rich guy who says he's richer than
Trump? He was mayor of New York. Oh, he's richer than, much richer than Trump. He could buy and sell. He did buy and sell Trump when he was mayor. Anyway, of New York. Bloomberg's net worth in 1996. Check out how quickly this increased.
96.
He was only worth a billion. I was driving in with my daughter, and she's like, if we had a billion, we could do this, this, and this, you know? And I'm like, we could even do more than that. A billion's a lot more than you realize.
A billion we can, and homelessness if you wanted to, you know?
Practically, yeah. So then you have, but listen to this. 1996 to 2019, last year. We went from 1 billion to 56.1 billion. 56.1 billion. 1 billion to 56 billion. 1 billion to 56 billion. What does someone do to earn that kind of money? Answer, of course, is nothing. You can't earn that kind of money. It's just ridiculous. Unless you're enmeshed in this machine of capitalist, you know, exploitation and greed and so on. But the rate of his ascension in terms of evil... in terms of billionaire-ish, I don't know what the right word is, being a billionaire, is typical. Because we usually give those statistics on the show, and in these articles, they're usually about the upper class as a whole, the capitalist class as a whole. Now the average CEO makes 50 times the worker, the top 10% own equal of the bottom 90%. This is individual,
and
looking at individual.
Poor me when you start asking for concessions. Like, oh, I can't afford that.
Yeah, where's the money going to come from for free transit? Where's the money going to come from for healthcare? There's more money to take your $56 billion and put it into the healthcare budget if you really care about people, Bloomberg.
And you can literally 50% of that.
You could have $1 billion.
He's still better off. $1 billion. Here you go. Yeah, we'll take $55 billion.
Exactly.
And thank you. You go off in your little land and your mansion.
And what's really sad is when you really get into the economy and money, we could let Bloomberg keep his $56 billion. I personally wouldn't want to, but we could let him keep that on all his mansions and everything. But as long as we control the businesses that he controls, the corporations, you know, the actual assets of those corporations, you know, then we would be able to immediately make more profit, not profit in terms of capitalist profit, we'd be able to make more wealth for people in a social society than... That would, $56 billion wouldn't mean anything. It'd be in pennies. That's how big the economy or uneconomy can be. It's producing trillions of dollars in value that we produce with our work. So if that work didn't go to the pockets of a few, the value of that work didn't go into the pockets of a few, but went for us to decide what to do with our own labor. Here you go, real democratic socialism. Then
the rich
can just die out as a horrible example of evil people.
And that's why they definitely will fight to the teeth.
But no, I'm not saying kill them. I'm not saying assassin.
But
I
know the idea of someone
they can have their fun.
Like, whatever.
They can have their fun, right? Socialism is not about taking over private property. It's about, except for on a private property that's already performing a social function. That's not a contradiction. It is a contradiction. It's one of the basic contradictions of capitalism. If you look at a corporation, a big corporation, that is social production under private control. And it doesn't work. It creates enormous
inequality,
enormous pollution, enormous
wealth gaps.
Wars and fights over, you know, competition, fights over cheap labor, fights over natural resources, tons of waste, etc. It's a horrible thing, actually. We're taught it's the greatest thing in the world, but it's a horrible, horrible way for humanity to be organized right now, or to be forced to be involved with. So we're not talking about Michael Bloomberg's house. I don't care. Keep the house. Doesn't mean anything. There's so much room in the world. But we don't like the fact that you want to control how many homes are going to get built through your investments, so-called. That you're, or you're
wealth,
the CEO. Built for profit.
It's not like you're building it for people to actually go live there in affordability.
Exactly.
It's built for more profits.
And that's a form of control, right? That's a form of control. We're taught that the free market is anything but free. The free market has the big stick. The big violence of the state always has to coexist with the free market. That's why the capitalists are the biggest nationalists. You know, talking about white nationalism, these stupid, scummy Nazis who do belong in prison, by the way, and do belong, you know, having nasty things happen to them. The real white supremacy, if you want to use that, or white nationalism, is the capitalist class, right? And that doesn't mean, and of course, that it's not reduced. You can't reduce it to color because there's plenty. If you go worldwide, there's plenty of other ethnic and racial
China
people that are capitalists, and they're doing the same thing. Exactly. But what I mean is that the nationalist part, really, and in the United States, that takes a racial tinge. But the nationalist part
is
deadly,
white,
but absolutely necessary for the capitalists. Sorry to... Go ahead, sorry.
It's been the white male who's controlled, you know, society and under capitalism.
Ever since they started to...
Slavery, you know what I mean?
Ever since they made slavery in the U.S. based on race, which slavery historically is not based on race usually, they made that...
So it was also white slaves.
They set up white supremacy, yeah.
There's also white slaves.
Yeah,
servitudes.
Yeah, there were, yeah.
Women,
well, there
children.
Was this thing. Do you ever watch Skip Gates' show on genealogy? You know that show?
No.
It's a fascinating show. I wish you would pick...
What channel?
PBS.
Okay.
Public, yeah. So what's... Okay, so Skip Gates is a professor. He's the guy that got arrested by the cops in his own home.
Oh, you talk about the he's from Harvard.
Yeah.
He got arrested in his
own house.
He had one called The Reconstruction of the Civil War.
Yeah.
The Reconstruction.
Yeah.
That was good,
And I'm not saying he's a Marxist or anything. Maybe he is. I'm not... I don't know. I don't think he is.
Yeah,
I don't think
he is. He's a typical middle, so-to-speak, liberal...
But he's taking... whether he knows it or not, he's using a materialist kind of analysis for the most part in these explorations of people's ethnicity because they're using DNA, they're using written documents. I like it. It's scientific. I find it pretty scientific.
I seen it once. I was flipping through a channel. Yeah. So it was very interesting.
I don't know. Maybe I'm too into it, but he's sort of... I think he sits back a lot and doesn't impose his own... whatever his fleeting thoughts are. I mean, there's banter and stuff, but I don't think he ruins the science, you know?
He's not a nice guy. I ran into him. He ran into me, actually.
He seems a bit, uptight,
what's that place? I worked at Whole Foods, and he was walking by, and I was like, hey, I just seen you. He just kept on ignoring me, like, doing this with his... I'm like, okay. Dude, I'm trying to give you props here, you know?
Yeah.
Whatever.
I never actually met him.
Walked into the River Street where I worked one day with his wife.
Yeah.
Or whoever she is. I don't know.
Yeah.
And I'm like, hey, you did the being black in Latin America, you know, in Cuba. Yeah, I'm Cuban. Yeah. He just like ignored me. Like, okay, kid. You know, like whatever. Fine.
He did that.
What's his name? Who? That professor from MIT?
Who? Dome? Noam Chomsky?
Noam Chomsky's another one. He'll just ignore you and keep on walking.
No, I always have.
Maybe he was busy. I don't know.
He was always nice to me. I don't believe in his ideas a lot. He's not really. He's not
a
socialist.
He was walking his dog and he kept on walking. I'm like, dude.
Oh, man.
Dude.
here we are with Lefty Celebrity Time or whatever. Not even Lefty Celebrity Time. But what I was going to say about that show was that he found out in the last show he did, I forget who it was. He always does celebrities, which I wish he would do workers, but more than celebrities, but...
Morgan Freeman?
No, Skip Gates in his show.
No, but did he interview like a Morgan Freeman?
No, it was... I forget who it was. It was someone who was white. But they found out that... Oh, it was Michael Moore.
Really?
Michael Moore. The famous film... Left, so-called lefty. Now he's a liberal, unfortunately. I have met him, by the way. He was pretty friendly. So Michael Moore, yeah. So Michael Moore is on the show last. It's just like last week. Maybe it was a rerun. I don't know. I don't watch it all the time. But so Michael Moore found out this, that his part of his ancestry was Scottish, not Irish like he thought it was.
Yeah.
Some of it's Irish, but a lot of it was Scottish. And his ancestor fought on the wrong side of the Civil War with England. Not Civil War is the wrong term. When the Scottish fought, there's a series of historical battles and moments and process where the British finally completely colonized Scotland. In other words, Scotland had its own clan, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. clan society influenced by Celtic stuff. They spoke Gaelic, all that kind of stuff. So
it's like Braveheart. Yeah.
Yeah. So Michael, but that was just one thing, but there's more than that, a lot more than that. And Braveheart, they didn't use any Gaelic, I don't remember, but there's a show on Netflix now called Outlander, which is kind of, I don't know, it's entertainment, but they bring in some real history, and they speak Gaelic a lot, especially the first couple episodes. I was fascinated.
I've seen that on the shelves of the
library. It was cool. Anyway, so what I'm getting at, though, is that Michael Moore finds out that his ancestor was Scottish, got in a big battle along with a lot of other people with the British, got captured, got exiled to America, I think it was. Was it America? I think it was America. As a slave, a white slave. But it did turn out that he ended up, once he was here and enslaved, they kind of morphed into more of an indentured servitude thing, and that somehow he got out after 8 years, which is about the approximate time of indentured servitude. But he was listed as a slave. Skip Gates made that point himself. He's actually listed as a slave, not indentured servant, because they had both back then, as you said earlier. And
that's interesting. I don't know how they do that. You just say, your grandfather was a fascist, or this, or that, or what the fuck.
And he got out. You know? He got out and ended up getting killed by Native Americans in Chelmsford, Mass. In an Indian, what they call the French and Indian War. It was before that, I think. And he was
so
killed.
America wasn't
so Michael
even,
Moore was like
America wasn't
yeah,
even America.
Yeah, Michael
like we
Moore.
Know it today.
Right, exactly. It was before
it was
the
still
revolution.
A colony,
I think it was
colonized.
Before the revolution. I think. And so Mike, because it was Chelmsford, Mass. You know, and that and so Massachusetts. And so Michael Moore is like. Then he goes into this thing. This was not my point of the story. The point of the story was just the white slavery thing. There's other people that have researched that stuff. The all of a sudden creating racial. Categories where they didn't really exist even in the minds of the people was a deliberate thing, and you can trace it through the records. The very, very first colonists didn't have that in mind, you know, but then fairly quickly, historically, like 30 years or something, they were starting to use it to justify slavery, you know, and to keep use it as a tactic as well to keep black people separate from white people.
You know that somehow I know through my grandfather on my mother's side, mm-hmm. Morocco. Because he can trace his ancestry back to Spain, Biran, which is basically Morocco on the other side.
Yep.
The Moorish link.
Yep.
That's my.
Oh, you should do one of those.
That's why a lot of people in Morocco will talk to me in Arabic. I'm like, dude, I don't understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
Oh, you're from. Okay, and they'll talk Spanish or French.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because like they say, you look just like, you know, like someone from Morocco.
Oh, really?
Like someone like
really?
You can be Moroccan.
Yeah.
You know, especially if I have a tan, you know?
Yeah, Morocco. Wow. Yeah. But what did they do in Morocco? What was their. What were they. You know?
Biran is literally on Spain. It's in Spain.
Oh,
but
okay.
You know how
right.
Morocco usually actually.
It was
had
controlled
control.
By Spain, yeah.
It was. No. Morocco controlled Spain.
Controlled Spain, okay.
For 700 to 500 years.
Okay.
It's debatable.
Okay.
Spain, Portugal, and France.
Yeah.
So if you're in South Portugal, Spain, which Biran is, people are a little more darker. They tend to be more of a, you know, they tan well.
Also, I've been to Portugal where the Arabic. I guess Moroccan.
Even the churches still have the mosques. They're not even churches.
Yesterday I was telling someone that wants to go to Portugal. I said, try to visit this city called Coimbra, and I was explaining why I thought that was interesting. And one of the things about Coimbra is it has this old Arabic quarter largely intact still, and it seems like it's really cool. I mean, basically it's just very narrow.
A little. This used to be an Arabic,
and it's still got stores in it. People are still using it. You know. But what were we talking about? The slavery thing.
The Michael Moore being.
Anyway, I don't know how we got off on Skip Gates originally, but that was why, yeah. But before that was billionaires. So here's the real thing I wanted to talk about from Jeffrey St. Clair, Counterpunch. The percentage of income, we have to listen carefully to this, percentage of income of America's 10 richest billionaires, from which they donated to charities in 2018. So, say I'm a billionaire with $50 billion. What percentage of that $50 billion did I donate to charity? And there aren't that many billionaires, by the way.
5%?
He picked the 10 richest. So, someone named Ellison, I don't know who that is. 0%.
Oh, so nothing.
Nothing. Paige, don't know who that is. 0%. Bryn, 0%. Bezos, we know him, right?
Oh, God.
0.1%. The Koch brothers, 0.1%, one of them, 0.5%, the other. I think one of them died, by the way. Zuckerberg, of Facebook fame, 0.7%. Now we get into the more liberal, if you want to use that term. They're probably all liberals, but the more liberal billionaires are the top 10. Bloomberg, 1.5%. The guy we were just talking about, who could have had $56.1 billion to play with. Gates, 2.6%. What a philanthropist. 2.6% of what? How many billions does this guy have? And Warren Buffett, who's really portrayed in the media as some sort of like charitable guy, 3.9%. Top 10 billionaires. They can't go over 4% of their income.
That's it.
For charity.
Don't nickel and dime me, man.
It's like nickel and dime.
We're going back and
It's nickel and dime.
We're going back to the Depression. That song, don't.
Oh yeah.
Can you spare me a dime, brother?
Can you spare a dime? They're nickel and dying us. They're not. It's not about dime. Hey, what number did you say on that CD? 3.
Number 3. Let me check. Let me see. Double check. I don't want to put on a song that.
That's all right.
That starts going F and F. Hold on.
Yeah.
Yes. Number 3. Goody Mob Decisions.
All right. Let's move on from the actual evil of billionaires to some stuff that's happening. Everyone listening, I hope you turn out to this event. It's a Lift the Ban on Rent Control, Massachusetts State House Hearing and Action. This is organized by a bunch of groups, City Life, Vita Urbana, and others in Boston that work on rent control, maybe some outside of Boston as well. Homes for Families, Asian American Resource Workshop, etc. New England United for Justice, Chinese Progressive Association, and many more, I guess. Okay, so here's the deal. We've talked about this in the show. 25 years ago, the Democrats, let's be clear on that, the liberals here in Massachusetts that have ties to real estate and the rest of it, they all pooled together and got a law passed to stop rent control happening. It was only in a few cities at that point. They got a law passed that said you can't have rent control in any individual municipality, any individual city or town. It must be statewide. And it's effectively a ban on rent control. So it took and the idea of repealing this type of ban has been kicking around here and in other states because they exist in other states. And it's way overdue, and I'll just read a little blurb here. 25 years ago, big real estate and their friends in the state house, that'd be the Democratic Party, say they're afraid to say that. Like, another digression, I'm sorry. Chuck Turner just died. Did you know that?
No.
Chuck Turner was a brilliant, activist, brilliant man in Boston, based in Roxbury, his family, and then he was based there. And he was elected, I believe, as a state legislator, many, many terms. He had an office in Dudley Square, which is now called Nubian. What's it called? Nubian Square? They just changed the name.
Is it
Nubian
I heard about
Square?
That.
Mm-hmm. Is that it? Okay. And many, many years he did that. And he just died. And I got this stuff because I'm on all sorts of, left wing and progressive Facebook and email lists and all that. And they were doing a memorial for him, which is great. But everything I read on Facebook, every bit of that memorial I read, and maybe it was, I didn't make it to it. I was going to go and I didn't make it. I always admired this guy. I didn't know him at all, by the way. Some people in my social group at the time knew him, but I didn't know him. And the thing about one of the things that stood out about Chuck Turner is he always ran as an independent. And he started the Green Rainbow Party. He was one of the founding members of that. So for many, many years, he's in the legislature, I think it was, and as an independent. Consciously so. He never took that step into the Democratic Party.
He knew not to be bamboozled.
So he's a hero. He was a hero.
Yeah, he stuck to his guns.
Yeah, totally. He had principles. He knew we needed our own party.
I will not betray my working class constituents.
Yeah. Then he unfortunately got some bribery charge or something. He went to prison. He got out of prison. He was still doing, that was just recently, and he did was still doing activism, but, you know, died. He was in his 70s, I believe. And it's a shame. But what I'm getting at here is that there's like this liberal, I don't call it a conspiracy, that'd be too strong, but it's some sort of like unwritten rule, unspoken rule, that we don't criticize the Democratic Party. You know,
don't, and
if you're doing a memorial for Chuck Turner, and you don't mention that he didn't never ran as a Democrat, you're just, I feel bad for you. I feel sorry for you.
Oh, they probably said, "Oh, he's a liberal," blah blah blah. No, he's not.
They just never mentioned that he ran as independent. They never mentioned the Green Rainbow Party. I suppose a lot of them have.
They want to erase that.
I think the people that, I think the gatekeepers in some areas, they want a career in the Democratic Party, or with the Democratic Party. Or they just don't understand their own bias towards liberalism, because they're liberals. But how does it happen, like, all the time? You know, like, I know, for example, some of the people involved in rent control struggles, I know their politics. They're covering up for the Democratic Party. I hate that so much. It's so wrong, because it prevents people from understanding what the Democratic Party is, and why you can't just be, oh, I'm going to be on the ballot line, or I'm just going to close my eyes and vote.
You can't blame Republicans, because it's been a Democratic, you know.
It's been a one-party state.
I'm sorry, not Democratic. It's been a Democrat
state. It's been a one-party state since when? I don't know. I don't even know.
Since Kennedy.
Decades. Probably before that. Meaning Democrats have controlled the state legislature, both houses of the state legislature, forever, just about. So anyway, every once in a while there's a Republican governor. Like now we have Sir Charles Faker, who the media likes to call Charlie, because they all love him because he acts just like a Democrat. I hate him.
I'm gonna stop vaping because, you know, it's
Remember? Well, you
stop vaping.
You always tell the story about when we met him.
Oh,
and he's
God.
Like, I think 15 is enough. I think 10 is enough.
It was me
10.
And Seamus and you.
It wasn't 10. No, but yeah.
We went
said,
up
like,
to the guy and said, hey, said, it like, was just a referendum question. And we went up to him and said,
I don't think it's necessary
or
something,
right?
So I
think it was, no.
It was 15 now.
I was there.
It's 15 now.
So Seamus comes out to him, asks him the question.
What do you think about
15?
What do
you 15? Think of $15? Yeah. You know, working, something about working. And he goes like, I think it's fine the way it is.
That's it. I think it's fine the way it is. I think it's fine the way it is.
He's got to like, you know, kind of like, look, no, don't go flip on these, you know.
Well, you know what was funny about that too is I think I mentioned this.
And he just walks, continues on his little whatever.
Yeah, I think it's fine the way it is. For him, it's fine. Well, one of his supporters came up to me, who was a guy from the building trades.
Yeah, it was weird. I was there.
And
I
was like,
this guy is like...
Yeah, he was like trying to defend what he said and say that, well, not everyone agrees with him on that or something like that. And I don't know what I said to the guy, but I should have said, look, man, you're hurting us. You're hurting the working class
if you
support
yourself.
This guy. You know? Yeah, you're hurting yourself. Exactly. Anyway, so 25 years...
He was a nice guy. He was
okay,
weird,
yeah.
Nice, but, you know...
Well, I mean, he's not the only... I mean, there's a lot of workers, a lot of our brothers and sisters and comrades who have illusions in the Democratic Party and cannot pull themselves off that drug, even though it's killing them. You want to talk about opiate addiction, let's talk about Democratic Party addiction, you know? And it's killing us. It's killing us. The more they do it, the worse it gets. But... You know, you gotta be respectful. You gotta be. You just can't hit him over the head about it. You gotta just get into it as much as you can.
Yeah, you won't get.
It's really gonna be events that change that, or events plus opportunities opening up at the same time. That's gonna change for most people.
You ever had that person that was so right wing, and all of a sudden they're like, "What are you doing here with us struggling?" Yeah, you were right. Because
no.
The situation. No, I'm talking like.
Oh,
I've had
oh
that,
I mean, I know what you mean. Okay,
the
yeah,
situation.
Yeah.
Historically had to change. They had to go through unemployment.
Yeah.
They had to go through this.
Oh,
they
I've
had
seen
to go
people.
Through homelessness to go
yeah.
like, yeah, you guys were actually right.
Yeah, the idea is that people in the don't change their minds fundamentally. And it depends how you define that.
Through events, I think.
Like what you're talking about, I totally agree with that. Like I've seen people that are very right wing on a certain issue. Especially a union thing, but other types, they'll all of a sudden be supporting of that. They'll be supportive of that. If something doesn't change fundamentally, though, if the process doesn't continue, they will flip back probably to their old ways.
But there are moments where
it happens.
All of a sudden, I thought you were, you know, like the Archie Bunker types. What happened?
Yeah.
you know, what happened? Oh, no, we don't cross the picket line here. You know, well, I agree with you there, but you were not too long ago calling me a commie or a pinko.
Exactly. Well, life is a big teacher because, like, take police brutality, you know, somebody could be extremely, just say, oh, they're making it up and all that, and then their own son gets killed or something. Or take I use the word opioid. If it was 10 years ago, I would have been saying crack or something, right? Because so many working class, so many people in the population of all classes, really, have been affected by that now that it didn't become, they don't use racist terms for it anymore. They don't use crack or something really specific anymore. It's opioid. So that makes it sound nicer because it's so pervasive. It's so pervasive now.
Well, the majority, unfortunately, the majority of people that are hooked to this are mostly white working class.
Right now, it seems that way. I'm not sure it's true, but it seems that way.
I mean, percentagely.
Seems that way.
I mean, I'm not saying that you would see a Hispanic person go that route or African American, but I've seen, but a majority of people I've seen on hooked on this stuff is usually white.
Yeah.
Irish or you know what I mean, like white working class.
Well, someone from Vermont was telling me, for example, this is
all these places getting hard. Kentucky,
Vermont,
majority of them are white suburban.
Vermont's mostly white, and they're having a huge opioid crisis up there. But what while we're on the topic, I might as well just say, well, okay, so people have studied this and thought about this, and events have forced them to move away from a kind of narrow, often racist interpretation of drug abuse in the past. To like a more nuanced, you know, treatment rather than incarceration and stuff, which is all good, a good direction that's going in, but they're still not talking about capitalism, right? They're not talking about why people are like this, why they need the drugs. It's not just the drug companies.
And they don't even talk about why. Is it a veteran thing for to begin with?
A what thing?
Veteran. The veterans are the ones getting hit.
Oh, veterans
are the number one.
Yeah, yeah. Why are they so disillusioned?
They're coming back and saying, yeah, take this, take that. Oh, you need pain because they, you know, the injuries or what have you.
And I totally like that they're going after the big pharmaceutical companies to a certain extent. Wish it was more. I like that a lot. But at a certain point, you got to get down to why people turn to that stuff at all. And if we were having this talk in the 60s, 70s, there were left-wingers doing healthcare analysis and legal stuff. Like, I just saw this thing on Facebook, which I remember really clearly from the time, even though I was a kid. Something like Marxist on the legal system or something. You saw stuff like that all the time in the 70s. Everything. Psychology had a left wing. Anthropology had a left wing.
Wow.
Yeah, they were all trying to figure out the roots of the problems and get at the roots of the problems rather than just sort of turn everything into a self-help problem,
homelessness.
A charity problem.
You wanted a Marxist analysis on homelessness.
Oh, that's easy.
That's easy.
Everyone can figure that one out. Speaking of which, that's a good segue back into the main thing. So Tuesday, January 14th, it's this coming Tuesday, from at 1 p.m., there's a big rally, hopefully big, I'm going to be there, for a major rally for rent control on the State House steps in Boston. To lift the state ban on rent control. And that's so Boston can get it, but also anywhere else can get it. Amherst, Northampton, Cambridge, Worcester. You know, Worcester's a poor city, and I do a lot of political work there, and I know it's poor. Still, the rents are too high. It's all relative, you know. If you're poor, your rent might be lower than in Boston, but still too high relative to your income. Still too high. Plus, Worcester's got elements of gentrification happening a little bit. And that's dangerous. That's going to jack up the rents.
Yeah, just like here.
Yeah, they want to build a stadium, a minor league stadium. They got the Paw Sox thing going. They want to build a stadium. All around the stadium, they're going to build housing, blah, blah. It's going to be really expensive. There's already a couple. Somehow, they got a Hilton Hotel down in Worcester. I mean, I saw that thing the other night when I was there. I was like, that seems a bit out of place. I actually walked in it one time to use the bathroom. And it's like, who goes there? I mean, I don't know. It's right near a hospital, so I guess doctors and stuff or something, or how healthcare executives. But anyway, there's a little bit of gentrification there, and it's getting worse. So anyway, show up Tuesday, 1 p.m., State House steps. That's across from a corner of the Boston Common, on corner of, like, Beacon and something. And you'll see the people there. And join the rally. Just make noise. I want to, like, I want to get so many people there. You just walk in the occupy the state house, you know. Now, just unfortunately,
like, whoosh.
Yeah, whoosh, whoosh. I love the whoosh.
I want to hear whoosh.
I want to hear whoosh again before I die. When we're talking about the whoosh, is probably one of the best rallies I ever went to. 1981 or 80.
Took place right in front of this thing.
No,
right?
No. This was a different place. This was a government center.
Close enough.
A white nationalist Klan group type group said they were going to come to Boston. And they said this on Rhode Island cable TV, believe it or not. They were going to come to Boston and organize and have a big rally on in government center. Word got around. This is before computers, and before internet and stuff. So it was like a lot of phone calling, a lot of leafleting, a lot of talking to friends. And I was a student at the time. And we all showed up, all the lefties, 5,000 at least, showed up. And the Boston police escort in a handful of Nazis. And you're going to hear the whoosh sound in a second. They open the door of a paddy wagon they had them in. And they start to come out. And there was like a semicircle of the 5,000. And a big kind of the cops had a line there. And all of a sudden you heard a whoosh. That was 5,000 people just losing it, including myself, and running towards the Nazis. And the cops, you shouldn't look at their face. They never saw anything like it. I saw fear. I saw so much fear in the cops' face. And they literally grabbed them by the arms and chucked them back in the panty wagon, pounded on the back of it. The thing sped away. So the Nazis got like literally like 10 seconds of their feet on the pavement. Then they were gone. The police were running back. We helped. We controlled it. We controlled the area. And we're cheering. We're all happy. We're all proud of ourselves. Police wanted revenge. They come back at us like three times.
With horses?
Horses.
Oh, God.
And clubs. I told you a story. This is the part of the story in my head. I'm there with Dave Plant, a friend of mine at the time. And I hear, you know, Dave's a pretty big guy, but he wasn't used to rallies or whatever. Anyway, I don't know why that figures in. But, well, here's why. Because all of a sudden he fell. I heard a noise like a gunshot, and he fell. They happened at the same time. And I started to freak out.
This is like Kent.
Dave,
this
you know, is like Kent. I thought it was Kent State again.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and it turns out he just tripped. I don't know how, but he just tripped. He was on the ground, and he was kind of laughing. And the gunfire was not gunfire. It was like something backing up, like a car or something. And what do they call that? Backup or something? What do they call that? There's a word for that.
The mufflers when they
do
that.
Yeah, exactly.
Pop,
yeah.
Pop, yeah.
Bad timing. Just bad timing. Yeah. And he was fine. But we were running back and forth like three times. Cops would charge. Crowd would force him back. Cops would charge. Blah, blah. We finally had control of the place at the end, but we had like 15, 20 people arrested for no reason. People with blood and stuff for no reason. Cops were idiots. But no Klan, man. No Klan. They did not get an inch of ground of public space. That's what we have to do. That's how you fight the Klan.
Yeah.
You want to know those? When they marched through Charlottesville or whatever that was, when they killed that woman.
Oh, my God.
Down
it's in
south,
Carolina.
Yeah. Charlottesville. When they marched through Charlottesville, the answer to that is the next day, the labor movement, every left group in the world, even progressives, liberals, anybody that's not Nazi or that's against Nazis, should have flooded that city with a million people.
Even the Jewish.
And if a Nazi person,
even the Jewish, you know,
of course, like that.
Been up there,
there was just a big march against anti-Semitism in New York recently. There, you know, that's the answer. Is you take the public space away from the fascists. You don't let them. It's not free speech anymore. Once you're a fascist, it's about, if you let a fascist make a speech from a street corner or in a public library or whatever, they're there to incite murder. Next thing is you're going to have someone lynched or you're going to have someone run over by a car like that woman was. No, sorry. You can have, I give Trump free speech, right? I would say, Trumpo, say whatever you want in your tweets. I would say right-wingers that I hate, John McCain when he was alive or whatever, speak all you want. But a real fascist, a real Nazi, you don't get to say that stuff. Go to your mom's basement and talk to each other if you want, but you're not going to do it on the street.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to do it in public library. I'm not going to pay for your murderous incitement speech.
That's like, were you there for the 40,000?
Yes.
March?
Wasn't it more than that?
You were about to speak. As long as you've seen
Was it more than 40,000?
I think it was 40,000.
40,000, you're probably right. I keep inflating
it.
Well,
once it started coming in, I wasn't a part of Fremont, coming in from Roxbury, Dudley, coming in with this crowd.
Yep.
Along the way, we got all these, you know, kind of like commotions happening.
Really? Oh, my thing
one
was,
guy going, fuck you.
Are you serious?
And then,
oh, my God.
He just got
Good.
He's just like,
oh, nothing like that happened.
Like, you know how to, like consumed by humanity, yeah, you know, like, what'd you call me, you know?
Good.